Welcome to the First Things podcast. On this episode, we'll ask Helen Andrews how to spot a dictator. Is charisma or is clientelism the real giveaway? Then we'll ask Matthew Walther how to spot a once and future King of England and when a fantasy novel is not a fantasy novel. Finally, we'll learn why Strunk and White are not masters of style and why it really is okay to use the passive voice. I'm joined on both segments by First Things literary editor Matthew Schmitz. I'm associate editor Julia Yost. Thanks for listening.
Crisis in Europe, ethnic conflict, a sense that our institutions have failed. We are in a moment like the 1930s when dictators seized power across the West. Americans are afraid that this November they may cast a vote they will regret. If we have to pick one kind of dictatorship, which should it be? Here to tell us is Helen Andrews. Helen is a frequent and brilliant contributor to First Things and to other fine publications that shall remain nameless. She's based in Australia, but she's in New York this week to deliver a talk at the First Things offices titled How to Spot a Dictator. She's also agreed to talk to us about her talk. Helen, good to have you.
Thanks so much for having me, Julia.
I'm also joined by Matthew Schmitz. Helen, in your introduction, you ask rhetorically, how do you know when you are supporting a future tyrant? If you are afraid that your presidential candidate might end up causing a regime ending, constitution shredding, permanent breach in the American political tradition. The obvious precedent to consult is the guy who did it last time. So who is the guy who did it last time, and what does his example show us about the nature of imperial presidents?
Well, the origin of the talk came with the hysteria around this election, and there has been quite a lot of it. You have Adam Gopnik writing in The New Yorker that we're facing the end of the Republic with a Trump presidency. And you have Andrew Sullivan calling the election of Trump an extinction-level event. And I think a lot of that is wildly overblown. But it is true that the fact that Trump got the nomination is a symptom of, or an indication of, the fact that we have reached a moment when the American Republic is very vulnerable, more than it has been for generations. The trouble with a lot of the hysteria on the left about possible dictatorship is that the visions they have in their head are all drawn from Europe, or really from Hollywood, mostly. And I think a more important precedent is an American president who was able to achieve changes in American government that amount to a change of regime. I think that happened in the Civil War, and in the 20th century that happened with FDR. So he's the one that we should look at. And in particular, the things that he did that changed American government fundamentally and permanently. I think a lot of people know that FDR, of course, interned the West Coast Japanese and used the IRS to go after his political opponents. And that was pretty bad and dictatorial. But the things that we need to watch out for most in a future president are the things that have a more lasting effect. And I think that there are many things about FDR's administration, the way that he enacted his policies and the policies that he enacted, that are worth examining and then comparing to the two candidates that we're having to choose between this year.
So in terms of FDR's policies that institutionalize some of these, you know, sort of post-constitutional changes, we're talking about the first New Deal, the second New Deal, the GI Bill, some other things too, court packing. Anything in there you want to sort of grab onto and just, you know, give as an example?
Sure. Well, the first and second New Deals and court packing and the kind of elimination of constitutional limits on government all belong sort of within a single family of changes that FDR made, and that was the aggrandizement of the executive. And he was very much a personal ruler who concentrated discretionary power within himself rather than working within the system of checks and balances. He didn't have a lot of time for Congress or waiting for congressional approval. And when the court tried to strike down his laws, he went after them. And the consequences of that we're still living with today. The administrative state, which is very, very much the characteristic of the regime that FDR inaugurated.
Now, Helen, I'm not sure that people are really afraid that Trump will change the regime. You know, it's not clear that he has, you know, that determined of a political agenda. He seems quite flexible. And so I wonder if something else isn't at play, a kind of symbolic politics or identity anxiety. I remember when Barack Obama was elected, I was on the Princeton campus that night, and there were these Dionysian shouts. People were out running around, and there was this sense of joy like I've never witnessed among my peers in Americana, a novel by this Nigerian writer, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She writes about how the protagonist and her lover make love that night because they're so enraptured and caught up in the election of Barack Obama. And the reason people were was that that my peers were so caught up in it was that a man like them was finally in that office, one of their own. Now, Trump is not one of their own. And so I think that there's just a dismay about having a man who, you know, doesn't show consideration for others, who's willing to say things that are politically incorrect, who's willing to say that Mexicans are rapists, things like this. You know, there's just an anxiety about having someone in there who's like that. They don't really care what he'll do. They just don't want him in.
Oh, goodness. I'm having visions of a flurry of baby Donalds 9 months after the election. That will be dreadful.
Only from the party of the right.
Well, I had two responses to that. The first is that you are correct that Donald Trump doesn't seem to have a clear agenda, but neither did FDR. He was emphatically not, you know, an LBJ-type figure who knew every pressure point in Washington and was able to ram things through because he knew how the city worked.
He also wasn't a Wilson-type figure who had, you know, really clearly articulated, intellectually coherent, you know, a theory of government and how it should work.
That's precisely right. And he gathered around himself, FDR did, a lot of bright people with clear ideological beliefs, and none of them ever got the sense that FDR ever really knew what they were talking about. He was very improvisational. He would take a grab bag of different ideas, and it was just his ability to blunder his way forward with confidence that allowed him to knock down some...
That sounds like really Trump, blundering with confidence.
That is true. But we have to look at the other candidate in the race, and that brings us back to the point you raised about identity politics. I think that, well, FDR became president at a time when a new style of politics was brewing in American political culture. I call it clientelism, which is a political science term, but it's really the reduction of government from going from the politics of principle to the politics of stuff, making government a matter of buying off constituencies and handing out favors rather than setting policy. That had been growing at the local level in America, and FDR brought it to the national level and locked it in. So we had a president who arrived at a moment when clientelist policies were kind of becoming a trend in American politics, and he locked it in. When I look at our moment now and wonder what kinds of new political trends are ascendant that a president might lock in the way FDR locked in clientelism, identity politics is the thing that worries me most. And that's why I'm worried Hillary Clinton would lock in that kind of playing various factions off of one another, winner take all, your identity is the thing that matters most in politics. And we will be stuck with that style of governing and of running campaigns, the same way that we've been stuck with clientelism since FDR.
So under a Clinton presidency, a bigot like me, someone who thinks that marriage has to be between a man and a woman, is going to be buried. That's your suggestion.
Yes. And I think that a lot of the people who look at Trump supporters and see white identity politics fail to appreciate the extent to which that is a response to just a growing trend of all political factions to see themselves through the lens of identity. And I think that's a terribly dangerous trend, and we should arrest it rather than feeding it. I think that being multicultural is great, but multiculturalism is not a good way to run a democracy.
So, Helen, if I understand it right, I think your sense of this election cycle is that Americans who are going to vote are going to have to vote for one or another candidate who aspires to be a dictator. And Clinton seems to you the more sort of full package of a dictator. Could you talk about what are the two most important elements of the dictatorial president and how each candidate fulfills or doesn't fulfill one of those?
Sure. Well, it's the thing that makes FDR such an interesting precedent to examine is that there were two halves to his sort of dictatorial qualities. And each of our candidates represents one of those halves. The first half is personalism, personal government, concentrating discretionary power in the executive, and that's Trump, because he's, you know, that's what it means to have a president as CEO. And the second half is clientelism and patron-client relationship replacing government-citizen, and that's Hillary Clinton, because in the same way that FDR took what had been a local form of patronage-based politics and made it national, Hillary Clinton is equally a pioneer in the field of patronage because she's taken a national model and made it international. I think the Clinton Foundation has allowed her to keep an army of loyalists on payroll and accepting donations while Secretary of State. And I think that that model is the kind of thing that, if it succeeds, will be imitated by others. And I don't think it's a model that's very healthy.
Some people have argued for Clinton taking as one of her strengths her, you know, ethical loosey-goosiness. I think, didn't Matt Iglesias write something saying that, you know, Clinton is willing to punch through any rules, and we need, you know, when our system has become sticky or whatever terms these wonks use, we need someone who's willing to disregard the usual checks and balances and just, you know, get stuff done.
Yes, and that's what makes it so dangerous to elect someone as ambitious as Hillary Clinton at this particular moment, when people on the left, the establishment left, not the fringe left, but Vox, Matt Iglesias, are calling for someone who can command this kind of executive power. A lot of people today remember that people called FDR a dictator and a tyrant at the time, and they think that that was just a slur thrown at him by the right. But there were a lot of people within the New Deal, or even during the 1932 campaign, who said, we think FDR is like a dictator, and that's just what we need right now.
Now, Helen, about these Vox writers, you know, the establishment, you say a lot of people remember that people once said that FDR was a tyrant. But, you know, elsewhere in passing remarks, I've seen you criticize our young elites, our young writers, for really not knowing history. So do people know that history? And if they don't, why is that a problem? You're kind of taking us back here for a reason, I think.
I think it's very difficult to grasp just how momentous a bad presidency can be if you don't understand previous momentous presidencies. And what I mean is that these young kids on the left who don't know that much history have really no grasp of what government was like before FDR came along. They don't really understand that pre-FDR and post-FDR was like black and white. It was as big a transformation in the nature of American government as the Civil War.
And this is partly an effect of just how radically he shifted the paradigm, right? It's hard for a lot of people, especially who are not steeped in history, but even some who are, to think beyond the terms that he bequeathed to us.
the idea that it was the job of the Supreme Court to keep congressional power within constitutionally established bounds, you know, rather than what they do now, which is come up with new rights out of whole cloth. The idea that the Supreme Court actually fulfilled that role and stopped Congress from doing things that the Constitution didn't delegate to it. If you don't understand that that's how things used to be, you really can't understand just how big a change FDR affected.
Ross Douthat recently wrote that because Hillary Clinton, I'm paraphrasing here, but because Hillary Clinton is so tedious and transparently vicious, her imperial presidency seems likely to demystify the cult of the presidency rather than amplify it in the way that Bush's swagger did, you know, at the height of his popularity, and Obama certainly did with his messianism. So does that seem right to you, that there could be a silver lining to Hillary's presidency, or not so much?
It is true and fortunate in many ways that Hillary Clinton is not a terribly charismatic politician. But when you look at FDR, he was extremely charismatic, but that wasn't the most important ingredient in his success. Far more important was his administrative style. He was notorious at the time for, well, they called it being a bad administrator, because he would do things like set up a brand new agency answerable only to him rather than working within established cabinet agencies, or giving two subordinates in two different agencies the same job and letting them find out who had what responsibilities. But that was quite deliberate on his part. That was not an accident. That was his way of keeping the source of authority within the Oval Office, rather than letting authority go out to his subordinates. A second, more important ingredient than charisma was his general attitude of lawlessness. The whole New Deal team just had a really hard idea thinking of the rule of law as something that might conceivably prevent them from doing something that they wanted to do. Their idea was you figure out what you want to do and then hire some really good lawyers to figure out a way to make it sound good. FDR, I think, in his particular case, that had a lot to do with just not having a legal mind. He just didn't have the patience to sit down and think through what the limits on his power might be. He was very impulsive. So I think that spirit of lawlessness is very much alive in the Democratic candidate this year. And in her administrative style, from what we saw at the State Department, was very much about making herself the hub of all power. So the fact that she's lacking in the charisma department doesn't really matter, since she has those other two qualities that proved far more important in the 1930s.
Helen, you attended Yale. Is that where you got your experience in spotting dictators or little baby dictators?
Oh, goodness. Yes, you do see a lot of young people there who really think they deserve to rule the world. I remember shopping an economics class. It was macroeconomics. And I asked the person next to me, have you taken micro? And they said, oh, no, because I don't want to learn how to run a business. I want to learn how to run an economy. You know, they think big and they refuse to think any smaller. When you think about what went into the 1930s moment and what made the moment so useful to FDR, it wasn't so much the crisis. You know, it wasn't just that the fact that there was a Great Depression allowed him to do all these things. It was more the sense that the old order had been discredited. So even once things got better and people were no longer starving, they still felt like, let this guy try some new experiments, because whatever it was we were doing wasn't working, so we need a new, completely new structure. I think people feel that way now about the old order that kind of came crashing down in the financial crisis. So even though things aren't as bad today as they were during the Great Depression, that sense of the old elite having been discredited still makes this a very vulnerable moment. But, you know, based on what I know of the ruling class, having come across them in my university years and after, I'm not entirely sure they didn't deserve to be discredited.
Amen.
Thank you.
On this segment, we welcome Matthew Walther. Matthew is associate editor of the Washington Free Beacon. He's written for First Things on Nicolas Gomez-Davila, Evelyn Waugh, and Sir Thomas Browne. In her forthcoming issue, he reviews a new edition of T.H. White's beloved Arthurian novel, The Once and Future King. Matthew, good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little something about T.H. White. He's an English novelist, first of all, who seems to have had a very English childhood. Could you expand on that?
English in the worst sense. So he was born in Bombay in 1906. His father, Garrick, was a superintendent in the colonial police force. And his mother was this beautiful woman who decided that she was too beautiful for every single man who proposed to her. And her mother used to tease her about it. So one day she said, fine, I'll marry the next guy I meet. And it happened to be this guy who turned out to be not very nice. He was an alcoholic. And after their son was born, their only son, she refused to allow him to enter the marital bed. So he beat her more, and she was cold and unloving, but very nice to her dogs. So he would shoot them occasionally. One time, a relative who was visiting, you know, like a country house weekend type thing, but the Bombay version, saw the Whites having a tug of war with a gun, and each was screaming that he's going to murder the other one and then commit suicide.
That's not very nice, is it?
No.
No, and it doesn't get much nicer as he gets older. As Anglo-Indian families did in those days, the Whites sent their son back to England to go to school, and there at Cheltenham in the Cotswolds, he was caned and molested basically every night after prayers in the evening. White says that he, and it's a very touching, sad passage actually, in another one of his autobiographical fragments, he says that he used to pray every single night, please God, don't let me be beaten. Anyway, after that, things looked up for him a little bit. He went to Cambridge, where he studied English, and then he went on to teach English at a school where he was much nicer to the boys than his masters and prefects had been to him. But on the weekends, he liked to go hunting and fishing, and he bought a Bentley. He used to tear up the roads with it. And he kept a diary of all this stuff, which he edited into a book called England Have My Bones, which became a bestseller. And his publisher gave him an offer, we'll give you £200 a year if you write us a book every year. And he took it and moved to this kind of gamekeeper's cottage in the middle of nowhere. And he reverted to what he called a feral state. And so because he was interested in English literature, he had read all these medieval manuals of falconry. No one really took these seriously as like things you could use to get food for maybe 1,000 years or something. But he decided to do it, and he lived that way for a while.
And so it worked out for him reasonably well?
He did, and he was able to get a book out of it too, so even better, another £200. But after a couple years of that, he happened out of nowhere to take a book off the shelf, Thomas Mallory's Mort d'Arthur, this great English romance about King Arthur. And he'd written a thesis about it when he was at Cambridge. And he wrote to his tutor saying, you know, by the way, back in the day, I never actually read this, but I did now, and it's really good. And that actually inspired him in turn to write his masterpiece, The Once and Future King.
Tell us about The Once and Future King. What is fascinating, interesting, classic, fantastical?
So The Once and Future King is great because it's one of the only novels I can think of in which the metaphysical claims of Christianity are taken entirely at face value. In the world of English fiction, you know, which is always about marriage and money and morals and manners and this sort of thing, we often see clergymen, but they're these sort of doddering figures, or sometimes they're sort of, if they're Catholic priests, they're sort of sinister or whatever. But in White's world, Christianity is true, and sainthood is real, and mortal sin is real, and has profound effects on the souls of his characters.
How does that work out plot-wise?
So it's interesting. He claimed when he read the Mort d'Arthur that so far from being this kind of sprawling, primitive epic, that it was a very carefully constructed tragedy with believable and memorable characters. And so the way this plays out in the novel essentially is that you have this, you know, orphan lad Arthur, and of course everybody knows the story in some form or other, who realizes that he's the son of the late king and is crowned, and under the instruction of his tutor, the wizard Merlin, decides that he has to bring justice to the land. But after doing so, basically, and bringing about prosperity and freedom and a certain sense of decency using the chivalric code, he realizes that that isn't enough, and that really what they need is God. And he sends them off to search for the Holy Grail. And in the meantime, his best friend and his best knight, Sir Lancelot, who has performed a miracle and has lived his entire life without committing a single mortal sin, ends up having an affair with Arthur's wife, Guinevere. And so basically, over the course of about half the book, we see the consequences of Lancelot and Guinevere's affair on the one hand, and Arthur's earlier tryst with his half-sister, which produces a son who eventually usurps the throne.
So how does this compare with my own favorite Arthurian text, which is the Disney film?
Of The Sword and the Stone?
Yeah.
You know, The Sword and the Stone is based on the first edition of that novel, The Sword and the Stone. Originally, White's tetralogy, the first three volumes all appeared separately. And when he published The Once and Future King, he revised The Sword and the Stone and made it a little bit less whimsical and fun. I think in some ways I actually prefer the standalone version. So the Disney film is actually pretty faithful to the standalone version. It's got all the fun stuff, like the duel between Merlin and the witch, Madame Mim, and Arthur being changed into fish and squirrels and things like that, and having these sort of fun adventures.
Are there animal sidekicks and things like that?
Yeah, there's Archimedes, the educated owl.
Oh, is he in the novel too?
He is, indeed.
Okay.
Now, in your review of White's novel, you note that this new edition that's come out is issued as part of a series of deluxe fantasy novels. But you wonder if it really is a fantasy novel. You're not sure that The Once and Future King deserves that label. Why is that?
Yeah, well, the thing for me is, and I should say, I think it's fine if they want to issue it this way, you know, if it gets it in the hands of more readers, whatever, it's fine. But I wouldn't call it fantasy because I think a fantasy is a kind of negative category, one that has these rationalist assumptions. You know, if it couldn't have happened, if it's something that we have to make up because we want to get away from the dreariness of our everyday life and, you know, hang around with hobbits and goblins and things, well, that's fantasy. Neil Gaiman, this science fiction fantasy writer who does the introduction, actually refers to the Once and Future King as speculative fiction. I'm not really sure what that means, speculative fiction. You see it tossed around a lot, but I just kind of thought that all fiction was speculation. Like when you're a novelist, you sit down and you say, well, what if these people I made up are real and did these things? You know, that's what all fiction is. But I mean, seriously, for me, I think something like the death of Lancelot, who in White's novel is a saint who even has the odor of sanctity about him. When he dies, his body is incorrupt. Is not the sort of thing that, you know, is comparable to like the wizard Gandalf flying on the backs of eagles to rescue a bunch of little guys from a volcano. You know, it's what we all aspire to in this world, sainthood.
Do you think that fantasy is usually used as a sort of derogatory label?
I would use it as a derogatory label, probably. I think it's a marketing term.
Right.
In some sense.
It clearly marks something as genre fiction rather than, say, literary fiction.
Right. And I think also when we talk about fantasy, basically we're referring to books that were written after and to some extent in imitation of The Lord of the Rings. You know, I remember I had a girlfriend in high school who was into this kind of thing, and she asked me to read the first volume of a thing called The Wheel of Time. I believe there are about 15 of these books. Each one's, I think the shortest one is 800 pages. I think the average is about 1,200.
I think I was reading the Left Behind series then.
Yeah. That's probably, you know, a tenth the length of this. In The Wheel of Time, the first volume, if you've read The Lord of the Rings and you remember that in the first one, you know, like halfway through, they get to where the elves live and they have a council where they make up their plan. That takes like 150 pages. Well, in The Wheel of Time, basically the heroes who live off in the provinces take 800 or 900 pages to get to the equivalent of where the elves live. And the book ends without them even having the council. So that's what I think of kind of when I think of fantasy. And I don't think that T.H. White's novel is really like that.
I mean, one thing that seems distinctive of what we normally call fantasy is the project of world building, right? I'm guessing that T.H. White wasn't interested in that stuff. I mean, that's nerd fodder, right?
Right. I mean, if he was nerdy, it was in the sense that, you know, he did painstaking research into, you know, the minutiae of all these things like falconry and heraldry, and he was reading the lives of saints and learning about battle tactics and medieval history and all these things. You know, he was recreating a world and trying to, you know, do so earnestly and with a certain, you know, respect for the material.
Which seems like historical fiction rather than,
right,
rather than fantasy. What do you think of T.H. White as a stylist? How would you describe his prose?
So I think there's a tendency to look at White, to quote him out of context and say that he's being sort of ironical or teasing sometimes in the way that he handles his material. But really, he's just being very dry. You know, if you've only read The Once and Future King, it might be easy to think that he's being sort of mocking when he mentions the God-distributing bishops giving communion to Arthur and his knights. But that's the kind of thing, that's actually very similar to the sort of style that we see in all of White. He has this very dry English sense of humor. You know, he's a very no-nonsense, like, robust Georgian man of letters, you know, who wanted to, he was afraid of heights, so he took flying lessons, you know. He didn't like killing things, so he decided to live only by killing animals, you know, for a few years. And I think that kind of, I don't know, it's almost, but not quite, Philistine. This level of like literalness in approaching the world carries over to his writing to some extent.
What about White and Catholicism? He was certainly not raised a Catholic. Did he ever cross the Tiber or come close to it?
You know, so his biographer, Sylvia Townsend Warner, has a great line where she says that White, notably free from fearing God, was basically afraid of the human race. He was a lifelong agnostic, but I would say sort of a weak agnostic. And there was a period early in the Second World War when he was in Ireland where he went as a kind of de facto conscientious objector, where he was boarding with a Catholic family and really became absorbed in the life of the church and thought very seriously about entering it, but never went through with it for reasons that aren't entirely clear. It's important to remember, among other things, that there are sort of class considerations here. You know, there's really, like, if you went to the kind of school that had prefects who could rape you after evening prayers, being Catholic is the most vulgar thing you could do. And so even when he was, like, living by eating squirrels and fish, he still couldn't do anything that low.
So, Matthew, you write for First Things. You're also an editor at the Washington Free Beacon. What do you look for in a good piece of prose? Who are your masters? Do you follow the noble school of Strunk and White?
That is such a dreadful book. It's held up as this kind of totem, or, you know, it's, I think in college composition classrooms, they put it up in front like relics, you know, for you to go kiss after mass, you know? But no one has ever opened it, so far as I'm aware. Because you find extraordinary things in it. Like, there's a part where you have what's supposed to be a good sentence on the left in the left column and a bad one in the right column. And the good sentence is, "Dead leaves covered the ground," which sounds like sports writing to me. And the bad one apparently is, "The ground was covered with dead leaves," which sounds like good English to me. But as far as the masters of English prose, I mean, you can never go wrong with, like, my top five would be, you know, Gibbon, Newman, Lytton Strachey, P.G. Woodhouse, and Evelyn Waugh. But yeah, it's important not to, it's important to disregard all this guff about, you know, writing in the most stripped down way that you can, you know.
No adverbs.
You know, one.
Passive or active voice.
The active voice.
I hate that weird prejudice about never using the passive voice. Sometimes it's really useful.
Well, it's frequently useful. And again, the kind of people who are pushing this on you have obviously just never opened a book. The passive voice is on, you know, every page of every, you know, important piece of English writing. You know, even George Orwell, who wrote a similarly bad essay called Politics in the English Language, in discouraging the use of the passive voice, uses it. The passive voice, I mean, the active voice is to be preferred to the passive. I just don't know. Generations of undergraduates have just been fed this stuff. The whole sort of Strunk and White, Orwell school of writing, it's not even meat and potatoes. It's just, it's Brooks Brothers, but, you know, writing isn't like dress, you know, at least not for me. You need some flair. It's nice when people can come up with, like, really long out-of-the-way words to describe colors and things like that, or, like, when people know the precise names of flowers and things, or, you know, if you can have a sentence that's 95 words long and has a lot of semicolons and colons. You know, that's really good. Or if you can have long lists, really long lists are great.
I love lists.
The best chapter of Ulysses is the second to last one, which takes the form of a kind of parody of a catechism. And the best question in it is, what in water did Bloom, water carrier returning to the range, admire? And Joyce has this 1,000-word paragraph with a list of admirable things about water. You know, I've always thought that's one of the best specimens of English prose, but, I mean, it's not exactly dead leaves covered the ground.
That's it for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to my colleague, Matthew Schmitz. Special thanks to our guests, Helen Andrews and Matthew Walther. No thanks to William Strunk and E.B. White for misleading generations of impressionable college students. And thank you, listeners.